Okay, so good morning, everyone. And I think there was a bit of a miscommunication about this trip because usually everything is in Thai. So this is, we're having a kind of a special short program so that you won't waste your journey all this way. We've got about half an hour. Probably the best way, I think, to spend the time would be to have a discussion. And if anybody has any questions they'd like to ask about anything at all, then please go ahead. Anybody? Yes. My normal day. I'll give you two normal days because these days I'm living alone, and my daily life is a little bit different from that of a forest monk living in a monastery. So for many years I was the abbot of a large training monastery in northeast Thailand called Wat Pa Nanachat, which is a monastery established for non-Thai students of Ajahn Chah. Our teacher, who's passed away now. So in a forest monastery, the day usually begins at 3 a.m. At 3 a.m., we get up and go to the main meditation hall, and there's a period of chanting for about half an hour, and then an hour's meditation. And then at 5 o'clock, the monks go to the main hall and prepare their seats and clean the hall. And about 5:30, the monks split up into groups and walk off into the local villages on alms round, which can take anything from an hour to an hour and a half. Come back and there's some free time. And then at 8 o'clock, the daily meal is offered. So we only eat one meal a day, usually at 8:30 in the morning. Following the meal is a clean-up period, and then the monks are free to return to their kutis, little cottages in the forest, where they can structure their own time during the middle of the day, walking meditation, sitting meditation, study. Some might be learning language or, for half an hour every day or whatever. And then there's a work period for an hour or so in the afternoon. And then we come together more informally for a cup of tea or coffee or fruit juice or something in the afternoon and have some discussion. And after that, the monks go back for a shower and rest. And then 7 o'clock, there'll be an evening meeting with meditation and chanting and often some instruction from the abbot, usually ending about 9:30. Then the monks can carry on meditating or go on rest whenever they see fit. So that's like a normal day. And since I took early retirement and I'm living in solitude these days, I keep to that more or less. But I have more time to myself than I had when I was the abbot. I don't have administration duties or teaching responsibilities every day like I did there. And I do some, apart from my daily meditation schedule, I'm also doing some writing and some reading. I'm an advisor to a number of schools, and there's a school here of which I'm the spiritual advisor, and once a week I go there to to teach the pupils and the teachers. Yeah. That's a kind of daily life.
May we ask for your story, like how you came over here?
Yeah, I was brought up in England and in a kind of secular society, really. I never had any kind of feeling for Christianity at all. I it didn't make sense to me from childhood. And I grew up more or less thinking that religion meant believing in things, and I didn't feel that I needed like a block of beliefs or dogmas to guide me in my life. I wanted to make my own way. But in my teenage years, I started to really question, you know, what am I doing this all for? You know, why? In England, you say, oh, why are you doing O-levels? Oh, so you can do A-levels. You do A-levels, oh, so you can go to university. When you're in university, so you can get a good job. What do you want a good job for? And then say, well, you know, don't think so much. You know, it's basically, you know, you're on this track now, and you just got to follow it and don't make a fuss. And I wanted to know, well, yeah, what's really a good way to live? Is there even a meaningful question? Is it possible to make a value judgment and say this kind of life is better than that kind of life? If so, what would be your criteria? And given the fact that there's so much injustice and pain and suffering in the world, do you have a responsibility to do anything about that? Is there anything you can do about it? Is there such a thing as good and bad, or are these things that each culture, each society decides for itself, and that you can't make any distinct or judgments? You know, there's no absolute standard. It's just what you agree upon. Is that that kind of postmodern kind of ideal? Is that valid or not? Or are there any kind of universal principles? So I had so many, doubts about life, really, I started to read. I was always a voracious reader since I was small, and more or less completely neglected my curriculum at school, and read a lot of psychology and philosophy. And eventually, I think before that, probably the nearest I came to a spiritual education or teacher was Shakespeare. That was the person who, for me, who was asking really important questions about life in a very compelling way. Eventually, I came across a book on Buddhism, and it just seemed obvious to me. And, you know, not kind of an exotic Asian philosophy, but just common sense, and just seemed to chime or resonate with something that I'd felt within me for a long time. And so the basic kind of direction that I got from that was that human beings don't understand themselves, and we're our own worst enemies, and that the root cause of all the unnecessary suffering in life is the human mind, and that it's only an extensive and comprehensive training of the human mind that can deal with the root causes of human unnecessary suffering and remove the causes why people create suffering for others. And I felt that Buddhism had the most brilliant and comprehensive and effective means of training the human mind that had ever been discovered. And that was, so I felt that the training of the human mind leading to inner peace, wisdom, and compassion, and then sharing one's understanding of that path with others was the path I wanted to follow in my life. I didn't know quite how to go about it yet. This is mid 70s, so I'm, you know, on the tail end of the hippie period, and they were the hippies were the people that I'm peer group that I most identified with. And so, those days, India was like kind of the place to go. And so already being very inspired by Buddhist and Indian philosophy and wanting to test myself for adventure and experience, I set off on the overland trip to India, and you're supposed to be like a gap year before university, but it wasn't very kind of honest. I think I didn't really expect I'd ever go to university. And I spent most of the time I hitchhiked through Asia and through Iran and Afghanistan and India, and went right around India and spent time in various spiritual centers, both Hindu and Buddhist. And 2 years passed before I returned to England, by which time, you know, I really felt I didn't want to do anything but commit myself to Buddhism. And at that time, I registered for a meditation retreat in England. And the teacher of that retreat had been a monk in Thailand for a number of years. And so he would tell a lot of stories about his time as a monk in Thailand. And I realized, yeah, like a Buddhist monk in a Theravada Buddhist tradition in Thailand, is that's the way of life I've been looking for the past 2-3 years. And so I made a decision to come to Thailand. And so I arrived in Thailand in late 1978 and was fortunate enough to be accepted as a student of one of the great masters of one forest tradition in northeast Thailand, Ajahn Chah. And I've been here ever since late 78. So what, 36 years now. So, potted biography. Anything else, Lina?
You said you were lucky to get accepted, but
is
there a test or...
Not really, no. I guess that's just a kind of a polite way of putting it. But it's pretty tough, you know. In those days, it's more, can you stick it? You know, really, that's, you know, you have a long period just wearing white and preparing to ordain, where, you know, you really have to prove that you can adapt to the life. Is in those days, I mean, the climate, I don't know if you've been up to the northeast of Thailand, but it's very hot and sticky. And, you know, with no electricity, it's a very, very hot and uncomfortable lot of the year. And, you're up for nearly 20 hours a day and eating one meal a day. And sometimes it's not just meditating. Some periods we're doing really hard physical labor for many hours a day. And it's not just learning Buddhism, you're having to adapt a whole new culture, a whole new language, and so you really have to be very committed to stick it out. A lot of people come very idealistic about monk's life and leave before very long. So so for me, I never wanted to do anything else, so I was always very happy. But I don't know if you know this about the monastic order in Thailand, but it's not like a Christian order where you take like a lifetime vow. It's completely open-ended, so you can leave at any time. And in fact, of there's like maybe perhaps 300,000 monks in Thailand, and probably only, I would think, 5 or 10% would be monks all their life. Many will be for a short period of time, a month or 3 months. That's been the tradition in Thailand, that a young man would become a monk before he starts his career or before he gets married, just as a way of, it's like a rite of passage. And in fact, in the old days, not so true these days, but quite difficult to make a good marriage if you've never been a monk, because a monk proves, you know, you've got some kind of moral integrity, and you're a mature person now. I mean, that's at least the idea. And leaving, although becoming a monk, ordaining a monk is a little bit more complex. Leaving doesn't even require a ceremony. All it would require is you to tell one other person, it could be anybody, that's it, I've had enough, or I don't want to be a monk anymore. And you would no longer be a monk after. You couldn't change your mind afterwards. That's it, you know. So it's easy to leave, and there's no kind of stigma against it. And it's not kind of humiliating or you know, people wouldn't look down upon you in any way. So it does mean that that kind of open-ended form means you have to make a commitment, you know, every day, really, unless you make a private vow for yourself you're going to spend for so long as a monk.
How about the role of women in Buddhism? Because
they
only ever see monks.
Yes, well, it's a bit of a big question. There was in the Buddhist time a nun's order, a bhikkhuni. These monks are called bhikkhus, and there was a bhikkhuni order, and that it was quite. As organizations or go, it was very successful. It lasted for 1,000 years, but then it died out. And so by the time Buddhism came to Southeast Asia, only the monks' order remained. So in Southeast Asia, the monks tended to create like quasi or semi-nun organizations, not nuns in the original form from the time of the Buddha, but a new form. And in Thailand, they're called the Mechi, and they wear white color. You may have seen them. Unfortunately, for a long time, the Mechi order wasn't really, even to this day, it's true to a certain extent, not given the same respect as the monks' order. But I would say in the past 10, 15 years, that's changing a lot now. There are a lot more, there are Mechi colleges and Mechis who are very well educated in Buddhist teachings. The number of them has grown, say exponentially, I would say. There are also many small, Mechi, nunneries, in quiet places in the countryside where the nuns are more intent on meditation. But there are a lot of nuns around, but they tend to lead a lot more quiet life. There is a growing international movement to revive the original bhikkhuni order, and there are some bhikkhuni communities in Thailand. The largest one is in Chiang Mai. The problem with that from the monk's point of view is that the monk's discipline or the Vinaya text, the original allowance made by the Buddha, has certain conditions which make it impossible for the original ordination ceremony to be performed. I won't go into too much technical detail. And so as this tradition is very conservative tradition, that's its kind of identity, as you know, we're the conservative Buddhist tradition. The senior monks have never wanted to override that, because it's like a huge taboo to disregard or override something that's considered to be the Buddha's own words. And so there's always been, as I say, this effort to create something as good as possible without breaking that taboo. But there are, say, growing number of women throughout the world who feel that's not a valid argument anymore, and that the bhikkhuni order should be revived. So it's point of some controversy in Buddhist groups. What I would say in Thailand, generally from my observation, and I think if you've been in any Muslim countries, for instance, in this part of the world, that the status of women generally is probably as high as anywhere you can find. And women, the percentage of women in management positions in Thailand is the highest in the world anywhere, including the Western world. And generally, when there is a woman who has some spiritual attainment and is looked up to and revered for the purity of their practice, then you very commonly find have many male disciples who have no problem at all about bowing and showing respect in the same way that people do towards monks. So So there isn't this, although there is, I say, injustice and say unfairness in many ways, underlying that, the good point is there isn't this underlying idea that women are second class citizens or that women are spiritually inferior to men. It's more than just the social pressures and things and historical causes, I think. Again, one more point is that monasteries throughout Thailand, and including the one where I lived many years, almost all have a section in which any laywoman like yourself or anyone can go and practice and meditate free for as long as they like, and can receive teachings from the teacher. So there is access to the teachings. It's just in the formal structure that there's still a weakness there.
Two questions from my side. The first thing is there something like a main book?
Yeah, that's a good point. I'd like to make a distinction between religions. Okay, so I would characterize the religions that grew up in the Middle East as a family. So you have the family of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. So they share some of the same holy books, but also the idea of what a religion is common to them. The idea that religion is basically a belief system. And so each religion has its holy book. It was like the Torah, Talmud, the Bible, the Quran. And your identity as a Muslim, as a Christian, is based upon your willingness to believe in the dogmas that are in that book. So you have Christian dogmas, Islamic dogmas, and if you can't believe those things, you can't believe that Jesus was the Son of God and he died on the cross, you can't be a Christian, basically. So the important thing to understand is that the religions that grew up in India are a different family or a different species of religion, if you like. And whereas I characterize the Middle Eastern religions as belief systems, Buddhism is essentially an education system. So it's a very different idea of what a religion is. And if you look at any of the texts, the Buddha's words, the whole feeling of them, it's so different from what you could get up by looking through the Bible or the Quran and so on. So you find texts which you would assume to be, you would generally find in a psychology textbook or a book of philosophy, and you wouldn't equate it with a religious text that you were familiar with. So the that being said, the teachings of the Buddha were collected after his death, and there are a whole five different actually collections of his teachings which are gathered together according to different criteria. There's one collection of all his very long talks, one collection of his middle length talks, and then another collection based upon subject matter, and another collection which is based upon sort of mnemonic device used in those times, where the Buddha will often base his talks on two of this and three of this and four of that. So you have a book of twos and a book of threes and a book of fours and a book of fives, and then you have miscellaneous. So altogether, that's, I don't know, many tens of times longer than the Bible. I don't know, maybe 50 times longer than the Bible. But it's not like a, you know, something that you're meant to read and memorize and is an object of faith. But the teachings are like tools to be used in this education process. So this education or cultivation can be divided into four main areas. Firstly, the relation of the human being to the material world. So that would start off in how you relate to your physical body in terms of physical health, nutrition, exercise, so on and so forth. Then your relationship to the world, that you have an immediate impact on how you relate to these days, to technology, to money, to your possessions, to your house, to your car, to your whatever it is. And then spreading out from that, your relationship to the environment. So it's a training and education of your relationship to the material world. The second is your relationship to the social world, how you relate to your family, to your friends, to your colleagues, to the society in which you live in. And the third is so those are two external forms of education. The two internal forms, first, the training of the heart. Learning how to identify and to deal with negative mental states, such as greed and hatred and jealousy and depression and anxiety and so on and so forth, and how to cultivate positive mental states, such as kindness, compassion, mindfulness, inner peace, and so on. And then the fourth area is the area development of wisdom and understanding. So these four areas, two external, two internal, form like a comprehensive or holistic system. There's not like a step-by-step process. All four have to be conducted simultaneously. So this overall structure is what I've been using in efforts to create a Buddhist education system, and in these schools that I'm involved in, and the school just over the road, that's kind of in which all the normal subjects are taught, but it's within this sort of overarching framework of an overall cultivation of the external and internal world of the child and the teachers and the parents, because they all have to go together. Yeah. Sorry, there was a second question.
The second question would be, which is kind of recurring what we were talking about, like also connected with this word of enlightenment and meditation, like connected with this, like how did you get yourself into this? Was it kind of a problem for you, like to focus your thoughts, like a meditation?
Oh, of course.
Like, forget your thoughts. How did you make it? And like how like was this process of enlightenment for you, the stages of how that connection?
Well, first of all, one of the important rules of a Buddhist monk is he's not allowed to discuss his internal development with someone who's, no, it's not a problem. Just, it's kind of interesting because the Buddha didn't want people's focus to be on individual monks. Meditation practice, first of all, point has to be made that for it to be an authentically Buddhist meditation practice, it has to be embedded in that whole cultivation. It's if you just abstract a certain technique and use it outside of that context, then you'll get maybe like a stress reduction technique, and it'll have certain beneficial effects and quality of life and so on. But it doesn't have that liberating, transformative effect that it would have when it's embedded in this whole education system. So basically meditation techniques all start off with the idea of increasing attention span and being able to be present to your experience. And it's difficult for everybody because when you try to focus your mind, you realize just how unfocused it is, and you realize just to what extent the world we live in is pulling you out. There's so many things which are trying to distract you, or so many interesting things, and they're at your fingertips now in a way that's never been in the past. So it's to use the traditional simile, it's going against the stream. So if you take, we know now that you can. Anybody knows you can watch a movie or something 2 hours, 3 hours, and you can sit completely still and watch it. But there, you're not making any real effort. It's something that's pulling you towards it. So it's very passive.
and the brain waves of someone watching TV or, you know, very almost identical to someone who's under hypnosis. So we're in a sort of semi-hypnotic kind of state a lot of the time in our life. So Buddhist practice is an awakening practice. So you take as an object something which is not exciting, not interesting in any way, like the sensation of your breath. It can be neutral, but it's always there. It's always accessible. And so for you to be able to sustain attention on that, it has to come from you. There's nothing coming from the breath that's going to pull you and entice you and encourage you to stay there. So you're developing this inner effort to sustain attention. Now, the mistaken kind of idea about this meditation is kind of really difficult thing, but if you just keep struggling, then you have the reward. You know, you get peace at the other end or some kind of goal of enlightenment. But that's a very frustrating way of looking at it. It's not a correct way. It's the process itself that you have to have this interest in, because what you're doing by attempting to sustain attention on a neutral object is you're revealing all of the things that go on in your head that prevent you from doing that. You know, it's like, you know, if you have any kind of theory, you learn a theory, but then it's when you're out in the field and you try to put that into practice that you realize how much you've really learned, how much you've mastered what you've learned as theory. And similarly, you only really know what's going on in your mind when you give the mind a job to do, to sustain attention. And then you begin to observe the extent to which the mind is grasping at present phenomena. If you don't have something right out there right now, you grasp at memories or imagination or fantasy as a way just to sort of entertain you for the time being. Or else the mind develops aversions and dislikes, and it's quite sobering and shocking to the extent to which these things become clear when you put your mind on the spot. Many people think, oh, yeah, I'm a very good, easygoing person. I don't get angry with anybody. When you start to meditate, you find all this kind of stuff coming up from the subconscious. You can get really upset about how someone sitting next to you, how he sits down, how he gets up, how he sneezes, how he coughs, or you get very angry at yourself because you can't do this the way you'd like to be able to do it. So you begin to see aversion in all of its many guises, from very coarse kind of anger all to very subtle kinds of dislike and moving away from phenomena, manifesting because you've given the mind work to do. And then there's the agitation, what we call the monkey mind, and then there's the depressed mind, when you don't have a certain level of stimulus that you're used to. Most people start to fall asleep. And this is, you know, almost all meditators go through this after a while. After you work through all the difficulty of the, you know, all the confusion, and you think getting somewhere, and then you start falling asleep because you've never developed that ability to be present and awake at a time when there's nothing stimulating you to be awake. You see this on planes or anywhere, you know, when you've had your meal, you've fed up with your book, you watch the movie, everybody falls asleep. Or, you know, this is the kind of default movement when there's nothing interesting going on. And that's something that you reveal through meditation. So to begin with, it's tough. I mean, in the sense of, can you sustain attention for a long? No, it takes a long time, even years. But you're learning about the mind, the way the mind works, the way the body conditions the mind, the way the mind conditions the body, the way different mental states, different ways of thinking, different attitudes condition other mental states, other attitudes, how to fashion, how to intervene in that in a creative way. So it's a whole mental culture that you're learning. So it's very difficult. But in the long run, it's really fulfilling, and it's like once you start, you know, it's like once you've seen something, once you've seen your mind, you know, I don't see how you can stop then, you know, because, you know, when you realize the amount of work that's needed to be done, and, you know, you've got to do it. Yes, I had the feeling I've got to do this sooner or later, better sooner than later. You know, yeah. So I'm going to have to end the session now, I'm afraid. One reason, because I have a very important engagement in Bangkok this afternoon, but also one of the rules of the monk is we have to finish any meal before 12 midday. So as I say, I usually eat a lot earlier than this, but I have a late meal on these Sundays, but I have to have it all over and done by 12. So, and I have a few more people to see downstairs. So I think that would probably, there are some books there. If anybody would like to take a book with them, then you're free. They're for free distribution.